us down. Got me running round in circles, grinning upside down. 7 AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. We are so fortunate to have Joyce F. from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, here to introduce her old sponsee. I'll let her take it over now.
Hi, everybody. My name is Joyce, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very happy to be able to be here and support Barry tonight. And I met Barry in 1993 at the NAVA Club. I became her sponsor, and we spent a lot of time together over the next few years as she got sober and finished school and became a nurse and got married, divorced, remarried, and had two babies, and we were a good team, and we spent a lot of time together. Barry's family moved from Atlanta to Richmond, and all these years we have stayed in touch via phone and gotten together when we can, and still very important in each other's lives, and I'm so proud of the woman that she has become and the things that she's accomplished in her life, and I'm looking forward to hearing her. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes. Hi, my name is Barry, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Joyce. I'm so glad you're here, and I have other friends who have jumped on from Richmond, other people who are really important to me, and, you know, it means the world to me, so thank you. When I went to another NAVA meeting, another NAVA Zoom meeting, and after it was over, Tim reached out and asked me to do this, and it really is, it's really special in a way that's, I don't know if it's hard to imagine, but it's just a really beautiful sort of rounding out of certain things, and just some things sort of coming full circle, not ending, but just coming full circle to this point. So, let me start off with what it used to be like. I grew up in New York. I had my first drink 5 days before my 12th birthday. It was New Year's Eve. I had been planning this. I had a friend sleeping over. I didn't know anything about alcohol, but I wanted to try it, and I wanted to see what the big deal was. So, the way that I tried it without having any experience was to take, like, a shot of every thing that was in the bar. There were probably at least 12 or probably at least 12 different kinds of liquor in there. I drank it, and I would wait all of like 10 seconds and say, well, I didn't feel anything with that, and then I put something else in there. So on that first night, I mixed all this different kind of liquor, a lot of it, and I was pretty immediately really sick, you know, just vomiting, throwing up, sick as can be. So sick that it actually kept me away from alcohol for probably another 2.5, 3 years. But the ism was already in motion in me. And by what I mean by that are things were never really quite right. I was never comfortable, like just comfortable and at ease in my own skin. And as a young, as a kid, this drove me to work hard, like looking for something to make me feel accomplished or comfortable or like, okay, now I got it, or now I'll be part of, or now I'll be, now I'll know what everybody else seems to know about life. So it worked in my favor for a little while. I also had that sense of irritability when life didn't go my way. And again, at that time, probably just thinking, well, when I'm out of this house, when I'm out of this town, when I can move on with my life, you know, then things will be better and I won't feel this kind of, you know, like everybody's an idiot type of thing. I also had a lot of anxiety. My dad and my brother both had diabetes that was not well controlled. And our house was often the scene of like ambulance, emergency help because of complications that they were having. So that was really a scary thing that was always kind of on the boundaries of what was happening. And I think that I had some unrecognized depression. It didn't come out in the way of me being like sad and laying in bed, but it's all these other symptoms, I think, was depression for me. But I was still, like, you know, showing up, going to school, making good grades, so it didn't look like anything was particularly wrong. It looked like I was a hormonal teenager, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it didn't really present in a way that was like, hey, get this girl some help. But what happened during that time, when I was still staying away from the alcohol, but I was still having all of these feelings of just like being so off inside, I needed some kind of way to feel better. And what was, you know, for a lot of people, an innocent, like, let's have a bowl of ice cream, let's have some cookies, that's where it started for me. But then, because I was using the little bit of relief that I got, and I knew that I wanted more of, so my answer was to put more food in my body and put more food in my body. And I developed a really severe eating disorder. I knew I needed help, and I actually asked my parents for help with that sort of right away. It was a secret except to my family and then a few close friends, though. So I went to a medical doctor, I went to a therapist, and they treated my eating disorder both, you know, with medical stuff and through therapy, but not 12-step therapy. There are a lot of therapists out there who I know who are very, you know, they understand and believe in the power of the 12 steps, but this was not one of them. She actually, when I told her or asked her about 12-step programs, because I had seen her for several years, she said, I probably didn't really need it, because in therapy we were working on making choices and self-empowerment, and I love this therapist, and so it probably steered me away for a while from like being as open-minded to, you know, getting into a 12-step program. But I learned a lot about my family in therapy. I learned, you know, some dynamics, some things, some boundaries that I could set, but nothing got better with my eating and the abuse that I was had around food. And I saw her up until the time that I went to college, and nothing really got better, but I had a geographic cure because I left New York and I went to Atlanta to go to school. I went to Emory. And I had worked so long and so hard to get into college. Like, there was a lot of stress in my house also growing up, because my parents, they lived beyond their means. They weren't college educated, but they also just really lived beyond their means. There was a lot of financial stress. And I instinctively knew, you know, from the time that I was younger, that and because I was able to do school well, I got good grades, I knew that that was my ticket. I needed to get a college education. I needed to be able to take care of myself. And so all of my work and all of my focus during that time was to get to college. So I got out of New York, which I wanted to do as well, because, you know, it was everybody's an idiot. That was my attitude. I went as far away as I was able to go to school. So that was Atlanta. I had never been there. I had only been, the only places I had been was like Pennsylvania, Florida, New Jersey. So I went to Atlanta and I started at school. And so I, the food was better just for a little while because it was a new environment. but the alcohol use went up at that time. I had been drinking through high school too. Let me back up a little bit. Like as the eating disorder kind of slowed down a little bit, then my alcohol went up and I was drinking with friends and not drinking all the time. I was doing a lot of stupid, dangerous stuff. You know, I drove drunk from the very beginning. I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning. I drank myself sick almost all the time. And the only reason I did not get in more trouble, I think, is because my best friend is like an Al-Anon, and she would always take care of me. She would make sure that I got home safely. She, you know, she kind of intervened on some of the consequences that I should have had. And some of them could have been very bad. I was very fortunate for whatever reason at that time. So going to college, then the drinking was like, you know, just untethered. And it was fun for a while. Everybody drank a lot. Everybody drank a lot. Everybody partied a lot. Everybody drank stupidly to, you know, so I didn't stand out as having, to myself or to anybody else really, as having a, doing something any different than anyone else was doing. But same kind of thing happened. Like I had a group of girls that I was friends with. I was close with them sort of from the get-go, and we all kind of watched out for each other. So when I was, you know, just in a blackout and just willing to, they didn't necessarily know that, but when I was just like willing to go anywhere, do anything, they would make sure that they weren't as drunk as I was, and they would make sure that we all got home together and didn't leave me like sleeping in a bush somewhere, which is where I would have ended up on my own. So I became vaguely aware that I drank more, I drank longer, and I didn't stop on my own like ever, but it did not interfere with classes, it didn't interfere with my grades, but the restlessness deep down was still there, and all was not like right with the world, with me, no matter what I did and no matter what I accomplished, no matter who I was with. Like there was this sort of river of uneasiness that is what moved me through the world and moved within me. So, you know, I had times throughout where the drinking in college was sort of fun, but then my eating disorder would like rise up. It was one or the other, you know, and woe is me to be addicted to two things. You know, that was kind of the way I felt, like, why am I having problems with both of these things? And if I could just kind of stop and get it together and have some time to sort of a little break from it, I'm sure I would be okay. My first introduction, though, to 12-step recovery was when a friend asked me to go to Overeaters Anonymous with her. That was the start of my recovery from food addiction. OA, where I went, read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I learned what AA and the 12 steps of recovery were about. And this started to set the seeds of doubt about my drinking being normal. You know, like the way that we read the big book in OA was we just changed the word alcohol to food and, you know, just substituted it and went through and just looked at that book in the same way that we do it in AA. Now, also from that time, from the very beginning, it was hard to relate to that book. I was, you know, 18 or 19 or 20, something like that, my go-around with it. And, you know, okay, it was the AA book, and I understood why we were changing it, but I'm not sure if I think that I really kind of wanted to pick apart and analyze how, you know, you could stop drinking totally, but you didn't have to stop eating, that you couldn't stop eating, so there were differences, and it was really, you know, that mindset of let me analyze this, because of course I was in college, I mean, that was what we were doing all the time, and that's what I was supposed to be doing, but that did not serve me well when it came to recovery in the program at all. It definitely got in the way of my progress. So, you know, through high school and college, my drinking was what I eventually learned to be alcoholic. I didn't drink every day. I wasn't physically dependent on it, but when I started drinking, I could not stop. My off switch, I used to say it was broken, but I actually think it was probably never installed. If I had any intentions when I started, I always moved the line once I started, and I couldn't control how much I drank. And I was also a blackout drinker from the very beginning. I didn't always black out, but I often did. And again, like, oh, I think that for a while there was a part of my brain that wouldn't let myself go, ask myself the question, do other people black out like that? Like, I just, it was some, you know, how we, denial is a really strong and tricky kind of thing. And I hung on to that for a while. You know, I never stopped unless it was removed, like the alcohol, or I was removed from the supply, or I passed out. And no matter how bad I felt, whether it was physically or hearing what I had done maybe the next day, I always went back to it because it was going to be okay this time. I wasn't going to drink that much. And I think that I also went back because it was the only thing that made me get in sync with life and the world. It was medicine. You know, it provided like a short-term relief for myself. It was short-term and it didn't work for very long, but when it worked, that's what I was going for. And when I used to go back and back again, I think I was always going back for that relief. The shame and the guilt increased a lot, and I started to try really hard to control. And I did a lot of that, you know, stuff that the big book talks about. I'm only going to drink on this night. I'm not going to have it here. I'm not going to do this. I'm only going to, you know, drink when I eat, all that kind of stuff. And what, again, as soon as I took that first drink, I would rationalize and move the boundary to anywhere that suited me, usually down my standards with that. So I knew where to go when I started to go, I think something's wrong here. And that was as a result of being introduced to OA. And I tried a few times. I went to a few meetings, but I wasn't ready. So this went on for a couple more years. The outward picture still really looked okay, but at this time then my eating disorder was really raging. Like I was binging, I was purging, I was exercising like all the time. And I only stomped that down in order to make room for the times that I wanted to be drinking. And usually it was a terrible cycle because then once I got drunk again, then I was like, oh, well, now I need something to eat. And then that would start the cycle. So I was physically exhausted. I was tearing my body up. I was full of guilt and shame, and I was really confused. I was really confused as to why I was really starting to put all my energy into, you know, finding the answer. I was with therapists both in Atlanta and New York, and books and this and that, and I could not make any headway with it. I could not make any progress. Nothing got any better. And the reason, you know, I just was like, why can't I get my shit together? Everything in my life is okay. Like, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. And it was so unsettling to know, like, all those things that I thought, well, when I get here, when I do this, then I'll be able to not need the food or the alcohol in the same way. And it never changed. And what I learned since then, the reason that is because the pain of alcoholism truly started when I stopped using the alcohol or the food. That's when the pain started, because it left me without being, you know, having that sort of anesthesia, not numbing myself, not having all of my energy and thoughts go to how much I hate myself and how I can't believe I'm doing this again, and also trying to keep my head above water with that outward, that outward picture of being successful, that I was still okay with grades and work and things like that. So there was no time left for anything else. Those substances were the only medicine I knew at a gut level that treated the restless, irritable, and discontent person that I was, like, at my core. You know, and so during the, for me, it was like a sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly slide to my bottom. I ended up just saying, I got to do something. I'm going to kind of go fast through this. And I stayed sober for a year. I went to meetings, I don't know why. Oh, I do know why I always went to meetings at this place, because the guy I was dating went to meetings at this particular clubhouse. I did not feel connected. I didn't talk to people. I didn't have a sponsor. I did nothing. I like went to meetings with him, hung out with him, and he was getting sober and some of his recovery friends, and made it to pick up a blue chip. And then I decided shortly after that that I probably really wasn't an alcoholic, and I walked out the door. And there was nobody between me and that door when I wanted to do that. No thought, you know, nobody between me and my thoughts. I just walked right out. I drank for the rest of that year. And then the bottom that brought me to NABA, it was December 12th in 1993. It came the day after a company Christmas party. I had blacked out again. I had heard a little bit of what I had done the next morning. And again, it wasn't actually anything too terrible. I did not like dance naked on the table or anything like that. But I was so sick and I was so hungover, and I was trying to study for finals for my nursing degree. I had already graduated with a BA, and then I went back to get my BSN. I had worked a year, and then I went back to get my BSN, and I was studying. And I was really scared. I knew something was really wrong inside me, and that it was continuing to grow regardless of what I tried to do about it and regardless of how good things looked on the outside. And I called someone. I do not know who it was, but I mean, I can remember where I was sitting at this table studying and not able to study because I was so sick. And I committed to go to a meeting at a different location. I was close to NABA. I lived off in North Druid Hills. And that's the one I went to, the 545. I was really scared because I also was questioning, like, oh my God, I did this for a year and I don't think it's going to work. I didn't feel like I was connected to, I didn't feel like I belonged. I didn't feel like it was going to work for me. And I knew that's what was scaring me, is like, what if it doesn't work for me? What if I can't do this? Like that, when I wanted to, what if I really couldn't? And it was really scary. But I went to NABA, I went to the 545, and I didn't want to, but I raised my hands, I introduced myself, I kind of briefly said what had happened, and that I was back, and that I was scared. And of course, simply because I did that, people came up to me after the meeting. You know, they talked to me, they gave me numbers, and I was never alone, you know, on the journey from that day forward, up until now. You know, I've never been alone. I think that, so Joyce is my first sane and sober sponsor. I know that there, I can remember specifically that I had one sort of crazy woman in there who I had asked, and the reason that I had asked somebody, this person, because I took this advice of, like, look for someone you could relate to. Now, when you tell somebody who's crazy that, they're going to look for crazy. So that's what I did, and I ended up, it was a short-lived relationship. But then I heard some more, and I heard, look for someone who is working the program. Look for someone who's talking about the steps and recovery and what they're doing. Ask that person, even if they don't look like you or you don't think that they've had the same experience, background as you. And that is when I heard Joy speak. And I introduced myself, and she was there with her husband, who was also in the program, and she, we made, I guess, a time to talk, and I had been with her ever since. She couldn't have gotten rid of me even if she wanted to, I don't think. So, I owe Joyce and Mike a debt of gratitude that's really hard to describe. They made me feel like a part of their family. And all the while, Joyce always was so gentle about how she, you know, pulled me through the program, or, you know, encouraged, pulled, pushed, you know, and just was patient with me when I, with all the things, with all my crazy and things. And I mean, and I know that's what we do for each other, but, you know, the first time somebody really does that for you, it's such a life-changing experience. And, you know, she worked the steps with me as much as I was able to. You know, I think that, I know she probably shared with me more than I was able to hear at that time, because, like, I heard this great analogy, which makes perfect sense to me. Like, in the beginning, like recovery light, it's like a dark room, and there's a dim light in the middle. And as you start to be in recovery, the light gets a little bit brighter and a little bit brighter. But as it gets brighter, then you see things that were in the room that you couldn't see. You just couldn't see. They've always been there, and somebody might have described them to you, but you couldn't see it until your light got brighter. And the only way that my light got brighter that I was able to see that is as I cleared away more and more of the stuff that was between me and my higher power and the way that I live life, you know, these defects that would get in the way of how I was able to manage. And so she absolutely, you know, we had a women's group that met at her house, and we worked out of a meditation book, and we did that weekly, and we hung out together, and we went on women's retreats, all of us, and sometimes just some of us, and we just hung out. And she just was always a safe and sane, loving place for me, and I know she is for the people in her life today. And even though we've moved to different states and haven't had as much contact, it's like that's one of those relationships that will never ever change, and will always, she, you know, I hope I could be there for her in the way that she has always been for me and for the women in her life, and she's just super special. So, you know, we did all these things, and in my first 7 year with the meetings and the retreats and the hangouts and the step work that I was willing to do, like some of it I think was big book stuff, and some of it was the 12 and 12, and some were workbooks. And then I had sort of like the messy crossover from working the OA program. So I think that also kind of was, it just kind of muddied everything. But I was still moving forward in the best way, you know, and in the only way, in the way I was meant to. So in those 7 years, she mentioned I got engaged twice, I got married, I got divorced, I got married, I had my first daughter. And then after having my first daughter, I moved with my husband. He's from Richmond. I moved to Richmond with a 3-month-old and my husband, where I didn't know anyone, and he had just had like knee surgery, and he was a very grumpy person. And I moved, and then like a few days after we got here, it was September 11, 2001. And I was busy, like from the time that I got here, you know, like I had this first daughter, and then my second daughter came along, they're 21 months apart. And I went to meetings, and I did show up at meetings, and I met, luckily, like another mom. She had just had a baby in August, and she had two other kids, and she also had an eating disorder. So it was like very serendipitous for me. We became friends, and we stayed close, and did our best. And I, you know, when I was here, I feel like life has just, came here, I blinked, and now my oldest daughter turned 19 a couple of weeks ago. That's how fast it feels like everything goes. But when they were really little, like meetings, I would get to meetings when I could. Not all of them had babysitting, so until they got into elementary school, like Amy and I would have these meetings, two alcoholics sharing, like we'd be in our house and like the kids are running around and they're banging into the wall, but we're trying our best to just share about some recovery stuff, and you know, that's what we did, and it got me through. You know, I didn't want to not go, and I always talked to God, but I didn't make the time. You know, I had every like quote unquote legit excuse not to be active in the program. So then my kids got old enough to be in elementary school. I thought that would kind of let me have some breathing room to maybe get to some regular meetings. And then my older daughter got sick, and she has an autoimmune disease that has like a behavioral component to it. And it took a long time to find out what it was. And it was hell. It was hell for her. It was hell for my family. It was a very bad time. And again, I still showed up to meetings, and I shared, and I had other friends in meetings too, and I showed up, I shared, I prayed, and I would talk to people at the meetings, but away from meetings, I was not reaching out to newcomers. I wasn't doing any of that kind of stuff, and it had been a long time since I had done any active step work. So then I had you know, there was part of me that I used to hear this in program a lot, like, oh, well, you went to a lot of meetings and you did work before, so you made a bank deposit, you know, like I do hear that, like, oh, I do all this extra work so that when it's summertime and I can't get to meetings, it won't be a problem. And I heard that so much that I actually thought it was sort of maybe a program thing. But what I have learned since then is that feeling it's good to go to meetings and it's good to have your head on straight, because that's really what happens. I don't think it's like a bank deposit. I think it's just if you're doing the work, your head is more and more screwed on straight, more and more aligned with a higher power. And so it helps when there's times where you're separated. But I have learned that idea of bank deposit thing is like saying that the food that I eat that I ate last week can keep me nourished today. I have to do this. I have to eat on a daily basis. I have to have a spiritual connection and do the work on a daily basis for me because of what started to happen, and I'm going to get to that. So I, as all this is happening, and like I said, having sick kid, having young kids, a husband, he's a CPA, he's busy for like 5 months of the year, he's like non-existent. I had all the you know, legit reasons to kind of back off on my program, but what happened was my untreated alcoholism grew. I wasn't drinking, but I was getting to the point where I was sort of stark raving sober. I went to meetings, but I was really plagued with the unmanageability in my life. And I thought that the unmanageability was because of all these external things that were happening. You know, my daughter's sick, the doctors don't know what it is. She's like violent at home. She was 10, so she wasn't like dangerous in that way, but she's beating us up. She doesn't remember it happening. She's scaring the shit out of her little sister. It was awful. It was awful. We went all over to try to find answers, and it was hard. So I hadn't done my own work in a while. And even though we could make an argument that maybe that was sort of legit, what as a result, too much of me got between me and my higher power. And at those times when I tried to go inside to find God within, like that inner power was blocked by, you know, what the book calls like calamity, the pomp and the worship of other things, you know, like, and worship in that regard, meaning focusing my intention obsessively on something else. You know, I was maybe worshiping the idea that medicine was going to fix my daughter and that needed to be the priority and I needed to put myself aside, you know, whatever it is. Like, sometimes the worship of other things is the idea that I am right in this situation. You know, so it takes a form. It's not just like, okay, I'm worshiping money, that's important. It's not like that. It gets a little bit more sneaky for me, at least. So I was not working a balanced program at all and hadn't been for a long time. You know, and what did that mean for me? Like, in the book, and I think it's the third edition, we don't have it in any of the fourth editions, but most of you will probably be, right, familiar with the circle and the triangle. And the sweet spot of recovery comes from being in the middle of that triangle, you know, and the sides of the triangle are unity, right, service, and recovery. So, like, recovery is the 12 steps that in the big book page, you know, the title page to page 164, the steps, like, this is what we do to recover. The service is what we do to help other alcoholics, you know, for anywhere from setting up the meeting, but to like taking people through the steps. The unity, is the fellowship, right? So we have the traditions that guide the unity, the steps that guide the recovery, and then the service piece is guided by the 12 concepts. So those three sides, right, come to those three points of the triangle, and if you picture the triangle as being like the top of the stool, and the points are where the stool, the bar stool, right, the bar stool or stool legs are. And if you are not balanced in all three of those, what I have learned is, for me at least, that my recovery is not going to grow. As a matter of fact, it's going to suffer. And so I could be really, really busy and look like I am Miss AA. I could be going to meetings. I could be, sponsoring a ton of people, and that's good. But am I doing my own work? Am I doing the steps? And if I'm not, that other stuff is not going to save me and not going to keep my stool balanced. And the other thing that I learned in studying the book is, like, being in the middle is of the, you know, perfectly in the middle. We talk about that. We need to be in balance. We need to stay in the middle of the road and all that kind of stuff. Like, that's the springboard from which my true growth is going to go from. So, it's a good check for me always, like, where am I at? Am I leaning too heavily in one area? And if I am I doing that because I'm trying to avoid the responsibility in the other area, not just that I got naturally out of balance, or am I trying to, like, do I not want to do the work? Do I just want to stay busy with everybody else because I don't want to do the work? I've done the work. I did it. And then again, that comes back to, am I trying to progress on work that I did, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? So it's a really good check for me to just see where I'm at. I kind of went off on a tangent there. Sorry. So I really thought that the circumstances in my life were causing this irritability and the discontent that I was having to grow, but those were legit things, challenges in life. But as we know, everybody in this program has challenges. Everybody has life happening, life on life's terms, right? So what I have learned since is that it was this untreated spiritual malady that was growing in me. Like, my internal condition, it's the same one I had since the time I was a kid, that I had not treated it in a while, and it was starting to manifest itself again. And, you know, how is it manifesting itself? Like, for me, on page 52, there's a paragraph that, talks, it's like called the bedevilment. So he uses the word bedevilment in there, but on page 52, we talk about, like, am I having trouble with personal relationships? Can I control my emotional nature? Was I prey to misery or depression? Could I make a living? Did I have a feeling of uselessness? Was I full of fear? Was I unhappy? Does it seem like I couldn't be a real help to other people? So that is untreated alcoholism, whether I am sober or drunk. And that's what was creeping up in my life and getting bigger and bigger. So at the same time that this is happening, I don't have, like, a real desire to drink at this point, although I have no doubt that that would have come because I needed some kind of relief, from my thoughts and how I was starting to feel. I still was busy both with my kids, and I thought I was doing the 12-step stuff I was doing to keep me sober. You know, busy, draining, tiring, got to keep myself sober. But I had this experience where the things inside, where the way I was feeling was just getting so bad. I knew instinctively that eventually I would use, to treat that restlessness and that disconnection that I was feeling. So if I take all of the, the substances away, the alcohol, the food, and nothing changes, I end up stark raving sober like I am. So I needed something to help my mind. I needed a change, and I knew that, but I didn't know exactly what I needed. And by this time, I kind of, like, left the whole story of the food off to the side, but I had also gotten some longer-term recovery with my eating disorder, but that started getting worse at this time, too. And I was so distraught because now I have a life and I have kids and I have all this, and I just can't believe that this is still the theme of my life, that it's coming back again like this. And I was really disturbed and afraid, and I had prayed. I said, I don't know what to do, and I got this feeling to call somebody who I knew from the other program, from OA. I did not know her well, but it was definitely a push to call her. I called her. I asked her if she could have coffee. We got together, and she told me, I knew I was missing something, and I didn't know, and I kind of just laid all this out, and she said to me that she would take me through the steps. She had a certain way of going through the steps in the big book, totally big book focused, and it had provided her with a really different kind of experience of the big book. And I was like, okay, because really, I don't dislike the big book. I don't love the big book. I just am sort of neutral. And again, never really felt like completely connected. There were parts of it that I'm like, yes, I get that. That's me. You know, like when I'm trading all the bargaining of like, I'm going to drink like this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to only have it after 5. I'm only going to do this. And then the managing, you know, the parts about control and trying to play God, there were parts that I for sure could relate to, but it had never felt 100% relevant to me. You know, it was written so many years ago, the things that we probably have all heard or maybe even felt at one time. It was written so long ago, it was about a man, it was, you know, the language is different, the time is different, but she said that it was such a different experience and it really made it relevant and alive. And I was like, okay, I was really excited about it. So we started the process, and it's just a way of, we started at the title page, and, you know, we talked about the triangle and the circle, which is not in the fourth edition anymore. We talked about what that means. We talked about the questions to ask ourselves, and I was encouraged to take every statement in this book through, you know, how it works, and to ask myself, turn all of those statements that are in there into questions about myself, to ask myself, is this me? Did I do this? Or did I feel this? Have I done it? Or can, you know, and maybe I didn't, but maybe I did. And by going through the first step, because I know I never did that, I don't think I ever did the first step out of the AA book out of the big book until this process. Going through line by line, by the end of that process, it's so depressing because it really leaves you with the understanding it left me. Like, here's my choice. Like, I am clearly, clearly powerless. Everything I have tried, everything I've tried has not worked. I am clearly powerless. So I must, I either find another way to live, a power greater than myself, whatever that is, or I'm going to end up dead or an institution or jail. And when I got clear on that, it makes doing all the rest of the steps so much easier to do. So much more, I'm much more likely to do all of those, like, steps through 2 through 12, which are sort of acts against the will. I am willing to do that. It has changed my life. I mean, I started this at 20-something years sober, and it just lit me up. It was like, it just changed. There was so much more that I learned in the book, a different way of understanding it, with studying it, with people who had gone through it in this way, and it has been so exciting. So, like, the things, that's what I want to leave you with, is, like, there's always more. When I limit, when I say, oh, life is great, but, you know, this is great. I don't really need anything else. That, I don't need anything else, but I want to be more free. And the way that I get more free is to have this ongoing, unblocked relationship with my higher power. And the only way that I know how to do that, because of the kind of person I am and the alcoholic and addict that I am, is through the steps. And it's really, don't limit yourself, but, like, I realize, you know, when I say, oh, this is great, but this is probably it, that's me limiting my higher power. And I don't want more for me to have, like, more stuff, more this, more happiness for myself. It's not that. It's like, the more freedom that I am able to get, the more that I'm useful to my higher power and people around me, and the better life gets, and the more things seem to make sense, because it never I never understood what I was doing. I was never in the flow. And I see it's 9 o'clock pretty much, so I'm sorry I went over. But if there's anything that you can get out of that, is just make sure, you know, it's okay to ask a sponsor, did you work all the steps? Do you have a sponsor? Like, those are important things, because we can't transmit what we haven't got. And when you're new in the program, like I said, they said, go find someone you can relate to. And I ended up with a crazy person. So ask, you know, have you worked them all out of the big book? Because it's the big book that promises you that if you do all this, you'll be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. And that sounds really interesting to me. So that is what I'm going for. So thank you again for having me and asking me, and I'm going to just wrap it up.
Thank you. It is so exciting to hear that you can still be growing starting 20 years later over again and never taking a drink throughout that whole time. I really appreciate that. Plus, your OA experience was intriguing to me. Back in 2012, I was hired to record the OA convention in Atlanta and got the full 12-step recordings with Laurie Chernick of Winnipeg, Canada. So I'll be delighted to share links with those with you if you'd like them. They cover the 12 steps specifically on OA. I was not a member of OA, but it was one of the best presentations I ever heard or recorded. Thank you so much, Barry.
Upside down, falling off the edge. This don't sound like fun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. Oughta learn a lesson, breaking all the rules. Try a listening session. The guilty lust and fool. Sleep away the day, hiding from the sun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. We gotta stop.